WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is fresh air. She dodged bullets while covering the civil war in Beirut. She thought she might die the first night of the war in the Gulf as she put on her gas mask and waited for the Scuds to hit Tehran. After 10 years of covering hotspots around the world, Deborah Amos has decided to take a leave of absence from National Public Radio. She will be a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and has already begun to work on a book. Yesterday, Deborah Amos told us about some of her experiences covering the Gulf War for NPR. Today we find out what it was like for her as a woman journalist in Islamic countries. Now that she's back in the States, she's experiencing some culture shock.
You know, I find myself looking on the street, people in shorts, people in sleeveless dresses, and I think, my God, they look half naked. And it's funny that you take on that same viewpoint of the cultures where you've been. It's very shocking to me when I come to New York City and see the way people are dressed. And I forget that it's okay for me to talk to a taxi cab driver, and it's okay for me to talk to the man who's at the dry cleaning shop. It's all the things that you do to sort of get along. And in the Middle East, you don't do that. It's an invitation, and you learn very quickly that that's a bad thing to do. I remember being in Israel once, and I was so good about not paying attention to anybody talking to me on the street that I heard a bunch of men behind me, and they were yelling at me, and I paid no attention until I looked down and I realized that I had walked into some wet cement, and they were trying to warn me. But I was so determined that they weren't going to bother me that I didn't even hear them.
Well, if you can't even talk to the person behind the desk at the dry cleaning place, how do you get the information that you need?
You can talk to them. Let me not go that far. But there's a way. There's no eye contact. You don't smile. You don't have those little pleasantries that you might when you go into the local 7-Eleven for a cup of coffee. It's a different kind of relationship, and you're very careful about the way that you present yourself to men in the Middle East. And if you do it, you pretty much can cut out all kinds of harassment. As a matter of fact, you can keep it to pretty much zero. It's a different story when you go and talk to Arab officials. I think in some ways, being a woman in the Middle East actually works to your advantage. We are a novelty, and there are government officials who will welcome you, who will see you far out of who I represent. I don't know how many Arab officials have ever heard of National Public Radio. It certainly helps a little bit more if you work for the New York Times. But being a female correspondent, they're curious about you. They want to know how you think. They want to know how you behave. They want to know how you conduct yourselves. And in some funny way, you are less threatening to them than your Western male counterparts. So I found that it worked to my advantage.
Because you were a novelty.
A novelty, and it also meant that I could see both populations. I could go to a home, a very, very conservative home, and I could go see the women. Now, my male colleagues could not do that, and they were missing a whole lot of the story in a lot of countries. Afghanistan comes to mind, Saudi Arabia, absolutely true. I could just get away with a lot more.
You wore a full-length veil occasionally to do stories, right?
Yeah, in Iran you have to. You can't get off the plane without them.
How does the world look and feel different when you're covered basically from head to foot by a veil?
I think if I had to do it all the time, I would rebel in the way that you see Iranian women rebel by teasing the front of their hair so that it sticks out from their veil. It's a political statement. I think as a reporter, in Iran I felt this very much, you become invisible. I could go almost anywhere I wanted if I was dressed properly because being dark-haired and dark-skinned, I looked as much like an Iranian as anybody else. And I liked the invisibility. There's something that's compelling about that. Nobody looks at you. I do sometimes think that the argument that the veil stops sort of the sexuality that is so prevalent in Western cultures is correct. Where I disagree is that in those cultures, it's not yours to give away. The reason that you hide it is not because you own it. It's because your husband or your brother or your father owns it. And that's where I have my political differences with it. But I don't really mind wearing it on the street when I'm going about my work.
Did you get a sense that the women cared for the things that they were missing, knew that what they were missing, and felt deprived of it?
It depends on what they knew. I think in Afghanistan, and I'll say that this was in Pakistan, this was in refugee camps in Pakistan. Some of these women had come from Kabul, where they didn't have to wear the veil. They felt, I think, the most deprived because they understood what they were missing, and they were angry that conservative Pakistani culture meant that they had to don the veil again. I think in Saudi Arabia, I certainly met women, two categories, one who didn't know what they were missing and weren't bothered by it, and two, there were young Saudi women, very religious, who had decided to turn their back on Western culture. They chose to not only wear the veil that covered their hair, but they chose to wear a veil that covered their face. In their minds, it was a return to Islam. It was a fundamentalist act. And it was a political one as well. And it was a choice on their part. Look, I think this issue is so complicated and has so many nuances to it that it's really hard to say you're for it or against it or they're wrong and we're right. I think that it depends on the individual. And if somebody chooses, who am I to say that they're wrong?
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Amos. And she's been with NPR for many years. She's on a one-year leave now. She covered the war mostly from Dharan, and also she was in Kuwait just right after it was liberated. She's been reporting from the Middle East for about 10 years. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. NPR reporter Deborah Amos is my guest. She's on a one-year leave from NPR after covering the world's hotspots, especially in the Middle East, for many years. In Saudi Arabia, where you were based during the war, there are religious police. How do they operate? What is their beat?
Well, their beat is the streets of the cities, and they have a character that coincides with the character of the town. Jeddah has an international flavor about the city. They are used to foreigners. It's a place that has Henry Moore statues along the seaside. And there, the religious police are not nearly as active as they are in Riyadh. Riyadh is the Quran Belt. It's the heartland of Saudi Arabian conservatism. And here, the Mutawa take their jobs very seriously. And they stand outside of shopping malls in Saudi Arabia, and they wait for women to come by, and they check to make sure that your abaya, the black cloak that you wear, is long enough and covers everything. And people tell just god-awful stories about them. A Saudi man told me that his wife was pregnant, and so her abaya, of course, was raised up a bit by her tummy. And the Mutawa pounced on her and said that she was absolutely flagrantly violating Islam's code and she should go home and get another one. And so some of them are incredibly strict. Some of them are volunteers. And the reason that they do this is because it gives them a sense of power. And they like to cruise the streets and find people who they say are working against Islam.
Were you ever stopped by the religious police in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, yes.
What kinds of things were you stopped for?
A friend of mine and I went to one of the big shopping malls in Riyadh, and it was cold, so we went to buy some sweaters. Now, it's against the rules to try on anything in a Saudi store because, God forbid, you should take your clothes off even if you're behind a bank vault if a man is in the store as well. And we were holding up the sweaters to see if they would fit, and a squad of Mutawa, like flying weasels, came into the store and began to yell, "This is a Muslim country, this is not America." And I was dumbfounded by it. And I always wore my press pass because I knew that that was what would guard me against the Mutawa. It was never spoken about, but I am absolutely convinced the Mutawa were told to lay off women reporters. I think Saudi Arabia knew that they would get a black eye if all of us were hauled off to religious court. And I held up my press card, and there was a policeman with them, and they backed out of the store, and they left us alone. But foreign women who live in Saudi Arabia have a rough time with them, and they wear the abaya and they wear the headscarf because it's much easier than dealing with these guys.
Did you ever ask yourself how you would be handling stories differently if you were a man doing the same job in the Middle East?
I hope it would be the same. I don't know if that's true, because I think that you get more sensitized and you are sensitive to different kind of issues. I couldn't drive.
Well, that's what I mean, just in terms of access. I don't mean in terms of...
And, you know, sometimes my male colleagues would say, "Well, you could just meet me at the hotel." And I would say, "You don't know that I can't drive, do you?" And they wouldn't. They would forget. that we couldn't do certain things. So you are aware of those kind of issues. You're much more sensitive to them because they're happening to you.
I'm just thinking, if it were me, I'd probably be really angry all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'd be, like, not used to having freedoms like this taken away from me.
Yeah. Driving was really tough. I've grown up driving. I've been driving since I was 14. I had a lot of trouble with not driving, and it did make me very angry because it meant that there were real restrictions on me. For instance, my male colleagues could go out into the desert, sneak around the military's restrictions on us because they could go and rent a four-wheel drive. I couldn't do that. So it meant that I was really stuck in the pool system because I had to depend on the military for my transportation, and that made me different.
Do the different values of what men and women can do interfere in a personal relationship when you get used to living in a country where there are so many restrictions put on women? Do you find your own personal relationships get a little out of balance because of the culture?
Yeah, in a very sort of small way, but it makes you think about it. In the early days, there were moments when you could hop in the car of a male colleague to go out in the desert and try to beat the restrictions. And I would find myself asking, would this male colleague let me in the car? Would he think first, oof, if I take her, it'll be dangerous. If I take her, they'll know that I'm a journalist because I've got a woman in the car. And I gave points to my male colleagues who would do it. And I will remember those who wouldn't. And I found this happening with women in the military. They would say, well, when we first got there, you know, our male colleagues would say things like, get behind me, woman, it's time to do the laundry. And they would say, it's not funny. And they'd say, and what they forget is at some moment we're all going home and we'll get them back. So those men who wouldn't roll up their sleeves in solidarity with their female colleagues got lots of points. It was all very small stuff, but it was important.
You said that in the war in the Gulf, there was really only one point where you felt in danger, and that was the first night of the bombing when you were in the shelter with the gas mask, and you'd heard that there'd been a chemical attack on Israel, which there, in fact, hadn't been. In the other wars that you covered, did you have many close calls?
Yeah, the war in Beirut was much more of a shooting war. You could find yourself, caught by sniper fire. You could get in the way of a building being bombed. It was a much different. It was what they call a low intensity conflict, where lots of people can really get killed, and you could be one of them. It was such a different kind of situation than the one that we were in the Gulf War. The Gulf War, it was very clear where you could be and where you couldn't be. There was no way to get where you couldn't be, certainly not in the air war. So you were fairly safe every place else.
Before you started reporting on wars, did you know that you had it in you to be in that kind of situation and be brave about it and, go about your reporting and everything? It's the kind of thing nobody really knows until they're in it.
No, and it never occurred to me. And I really had to Beirut was the test of it. And I had to think about it later, about why I would have even put up with any of it. And I think that the real answer is that I don't have an imagination. I don't think it has anything to do with courage. But I can't imagine. And so since I can't imagine, I'm not worried about it. I mean, I had a long conversation one night with a colleague who refused to be on a ground combat pool. And I said, why? He said, because I'm afraid of fuel air explosions. I said, you are? He said, yes. And I'm afraid that if I'm on a ground combat pool that I will be there when one occurs. Well, I knew vaguely about fuel air explosions, but I couldn't imagine in my mind what one would look like. And I couldn't imagine that I would be in a place where it would suck out all of my breath and burn me into a cinder. Now, my colleague could imagine that. And so he didn't want to have anything to do with it. In my case, I really don't think it's courage. I just don't think that I can think up those things.
Well, you're beginning a one-year leave from NPR. Are you looking ahead past that year to what you're going to do afterwards?
I'm trying not to. I would like the whole point of this year to not be a preparation for what I'm going to do when I go back, but rather to be a year of reflection. And since I have the rest of my life ahead of me, I got plenty of time to think about what I'll do when I go back. But what I won't have again is 9 months to read and think and reflect and ask all the questions that I couldn't ask when I was working and find out in detail what's happened in other parts of the world where I haven't been paying attention. And the other thing is that I have essentially been out of this country for almost 10 years, and I realize that my Americanness is fading. So part of it is I want to come back and watch television and eat hamburgers and do the things that Americans do so that I can brush up on my Americanness.
Deborah Amos is a reporter for National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air.